Welcome to this episode of the Justice Team podcast on the Justice Team Network. And this episode, we have the pleasure of Jonathan Michaels, who is a product liability guru, and he's the first one to try a Tesla autopilot defect case here in California. Jonathan Michaels comes to us from Newport Beach, California. He's known as the, is it just productdefect.com? What's your website?
Good question. Defectattorney.com.
Defectattorney.com. My wife says I'm a defective attorney. First of all, Jonathan, how do people find you? Can you give like your, where they can find you? Because we're going to have a lot of people reach out about these questions. If they have a case against Tesla they may need help on or just questions, how do they find you?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking. The name of the firm is MLG, Attorneys at Law. You can Google that, but the best way to find us is just go to Google and defectattorney.com.
Defectattorney.com. Have you reached the point yet? I mean, I'm sure where other people try to pay for your name or your website to rank higher on Google.
Yeah.
It's very annoying.
It is. I mean, we're fortunate to get the name defectattorney.com quite some time ago. And, you know, I'm never letting that go.
Yeah. So first thing, you know, I think a lot of listeners, when they get a product case, they underestimate how much work it is.
That's very true.
Yeah. So, I mean, you obviously had a 6-8 week trial, I would assume?
Yeah, it was a 7-week jury trial out in Riverside. Mm-hmm. And that's actually the small part of it. It's the couple years of workup and then the intensive 2 months right before trial. I mean, we had 25 expert witnesses between both sides.
Yeah. And I think that's, and how much, if you don't mind me asking, how much cost did you have to front just for that case?
Yeah, we had about $900,000 in hard costs.
And that's what a lot of people don't realize. I tried one case against Honda and we were over $1 million.
Yeah.
For just, because you know, you're doing vehicle recreations, rebuilds, and it's expensive.
I mean, what people see, and I think what attracts people to it is there's very large injuries and mm-hmm. so very significant injuries. And they see that and like, okay, we can handle that. But what they're not understanding is the level of engineering. And the expert witnesses you need for that, and they have to be world-class. I mean, you have to go up against, in your case, Honda, in our case, Tesla, and you have to beat the engineers who built the product.
Yep. And also the consumer expectation that I like this brand, I like them, they're safe.
That's true.
The defense in every one of these cases is user error.
Yeah, it is. And we had the jury trial we just did. We had a number of potential jurors that had Teslas. They were Tesla fan club members, and that's an issue that you have to deal with. But then the opposite also can happen, which is you have some people that, are very distrustful of some of the brands.
Yeah. And some states or jurisdictions don't even get to ask jurors questions. You're kind of just, dealt the hand that you get. But I want to talk about jury selection. We're going to work our way backwards. And, these are very, very intense cases, labor intensive, hours and hours of work, build up expert depositions. And you pretty much have to be a sub-technical lawyer. Do you have any engineering background?
I don't, but I'm super analytical. I mean, yeah. I could have been an engineer if I didn't go into this profession. And you have to have a mind that just works that way. You have to understand the science. You have to really even know what the experts are not alluding to and take them down the right path. And you just have to understand engineering principles solid.
Yeah, and that's where you have to lean on mentors and other in this space. And there's a fantastic organization called AIEG. You're a member of this
team?
Yeah,
that's a big deal.
Yeah, so let the listeners know what that is and how you can try to get in.
Yeah, AIEG is the Attorney Information Exchange Group, nationwide organization of all product defect attorneys. And it's a great organization. They meet twice a year. There's several hundred members. And there's an amazing listserv, really a great group of people that you can go to for information. And, I mean, we do product defect stuff, but sometimes you'll get a case that's just on the fringes of things that we do on a regular basis. And so you reach out and inevitably you'll get an expert within a day of like, oh, you got to use this guy. He's great for those, those rare cases.
Yeah. And there's another alpha called the Expert Institute, and they have a platform called Expert IQ, which is fantastic. But AIEG, which I do love and a member of as well, and you have to like have credentials, apply to get in, you go through like a process, you have the work product waiver and stuff like that. So it's not easy.
It's funny because it is. It's very true. You really have to apply to be in. And there's they call it sort of a virtual warehouse where we put briefs in, we put deposition transcripts. And so literally every time you log on to the website, you have to affirm that you won't share this outside what their principles are. You're not part of the defense firms. And the sharing is very, very, very deep.
Mm-hmm. And, nationwide lawyers, like a community, they have their own firms, but pull together. And that's, whenever we had an expert, there's you guys out of Florida and the group out of Arizona that does pretty much work for auto manufacturers. And we were just tracking experts through the network of AIG. Where were they testifying the week before? What were they talking about? You bring in boxes of depositions that they had just given in trial testimony, and it could be a very bad day for the defense experts, but you gotta be prepared.
You gotta be prepared and you gotta do the work, and it's a lot of work, and it's hard work, and it's deep work, and it's just something that it just doesn't jump off the page. I mean, you really have to dig and dig and dig in these cases.
So, I mean, you're going up in, you know, Riverside, California. California is a very, you know, tech savvy state. And, you know, you have a lot of people that are very pro EVs. You have some people that are very anti, you know, EVs. So talk us about jury selection. Kind of what was your method? What were you looking for? That kind of stuff.
So, you know, it's interesting. We went through 150 jurors to get to our 12. And we had four alternates. And it was a very difficult process. It took quite some time. One of the issues we had is that Tesla is just a big name. It's a big brand right now. And so people that either have Teslas or have shares of stock in Tesla or have biases, you know, in favor of Tesla. And we burned through a lot of jurors. As a matter of fact, our trial judge has the exact same car that was at issue in our case.
What was the car at issue?
It was a Tesla Model 3.
Oh, man. Who was your judge?
Chris Harmon. Great judge.
Yeah. Riverside has great judges.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I actually have two Teslas. I've had Teslas for like 10 years.
So they're okay cars. Just don't use the autopilot.
Exactly. And I think, I mean, I have it on both vehicles. We have two Model Xs, and I will use it on the freeway in the carpool lane, but I always have my hands and feet there just so I can have it's actually another set of eyes. But I just don't get where people will. I know people that are like, I turn it on and I go to sleep in the car. I was like, are you insane?
Well, you know, the issue is that Tesla really fosters that belief, and that's really a lot of their marketing is they're fostering this belief of the car will drive itself, and people fall for that. And the reality is it's a very low level system in terms of the automation that it supplies. And people just don't have an appreciation of really how hypervigilant you need to be when you use these cars.
And it seems to me like these cases, and I did not see any of the trial I heard a lot about, I was following it, but you have this big battle against like, okay, even if Tesla could have done better, even if their product wasn't up to par, it's still this person's fault. Right. That's probably the hardest part of the case.
It is. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny because they talk out of both sides of the mouth. Oh, when they're selling the cars, they're marketing it. It's like, oh, the car is the greatest thing. And it almost drives itself. But when it comes time to standing in front of a jury, they're like, well, on page 912 of the owner's manual here in 4-point font, it says you always have to have your hands on the wheel. And so they'd love to point to that.
Oh.
And, I mean, it's so hypocritical.
So you have, I mean, just for our listeners, when you do a product liability case, it's not just one cause of action. It's just not one theory of liability when you get to trial. One of them is failure to warn. One of them is consumer expectation test, which
right.
California, I think it's the only California that has that kind of language for consumer expectation.
That's pretty much correct.
Yeah. And then there's some other ones for like proper design, et cetera, straight negligence. This is why you need a specialist to try these cases. Cause when these juries get the verdict form alone, it's like five or six pages.
It certainly can be. You can have, you know, 40 questions that the jury's answering, and they can get really tripped up. And so one of the things that we really try to do for all of our products cases is we do focus groups, a lot of focus groups, really in large part to get the verdict form correct.
You know,
so they're not getting tripped up on it, because we've had jurors, and we watch them when they deliberate, like in our focus groups. And you can see these jurors can get tripped up. They're just not understanding the language of the question. So we spend an enormous amount of time on the verdict form.
So you have your beautiful mock courtroom, which we were looking at photos of, and it's better than most federal courthouses, especially state courthouses. So walk us through how you go through, and I think it's important for people to understand. I'm sorry we keep pivoting, listeners. I'm fascinated by this shit. So you have your mock courtroom, and I assume you're doing what we call focus groups. Kind of explain how you do this.
So, you know, we put on mock trials, and we do these all the time. I actually did one just 2 days ago. We're doing these once a week, once every 2 weeks. And we literally bring in a mock jury. So we'll have generally 12 jurors in the panel, and we'll pick a jury depending on what we're looking for. Sometimes it might be that's going to resemble the jurisdiction. Sometimes I might want an extremely conservative jury to see, okay, like this is the worst jury that I could get. You know, how do I do with them? And, you know, we have a number of different ways that we do it. My favorite way is when we do sort of a blended opening and closing. Mm-hmm. So it's explaining the story, but with a little bit of argument. And then we give them the verdict form. We have them do an individual verdict form. And this is a fascinating part. So we can see where each person is with their own thoughts. And then they send them into a deliberation room and let them, we actually make them deliberate to a verdict and see how it changes. And one of the things that's really interesting about that is you start learning personality types and like, okay, this person gave us 30 million individually, but then they folded and went down to 6 million with a group. Why did that happen? Mm-hmm. And what does that person need to feel secure?
Do you make them do like those personality tests before?
We don't do personality tests, but we get an enormous amount of data on them. So we know, we know everything about them.
Yeah. And I think that's, this is just the art of, we could speak forever of picking juries and figuring out personality types, but yeah, that's a big thing. Like there's a big bunch of consumer data, how they sell products and where based off of your personality type. Right. So it's like, we should be doing this. And a lot of us are doing this in jury trial, but it's a big lift, man.
It is. And, I think that getting back to the Tesla trial, we had several days of jury selection. We got down to the last day. We had 10 jurors that were iced in the case. So they were going to be in the case and all 10 were really good for us. And we get to the last day of the jury selection and jurors 11 and 12. And we had two peremptories left and we had to save those for also the alternates. And so we had last juror came in and it was tough. That person was, she was a very nice lady, but a very commanding personality. And if she's with us, we're good. If she's against us, she's pulling people.
Yeah. And that's what, a lot of people that they'll teach picking juries is it's really jury deselection and you got to get the bad jurors that pull the other ones out.
Yeah. And you really have to save your ammunition. I mean, there's a temptation like, okay, let's get this person out on the early stages. Like, but you don't know what's coming down the corner next.
Correct.
And that can be tough.
And do you, when you pick your juries, do you do it as a team? Do you have a jury consultant? What's that look like?
All of the above. We have a jury consultant and it's reading the tea leaves. This is funny you ask because with our mock trials, this is how intelligent we get with this. So we have everyone from our office that we think can read people well come in, and we have a lot of people in our office, and read the jurors. And so we actually rank ourselves internally at how well they pick the jury, how well they pick the jurors. And so we then have number one person, number two person, all the way down to, number 30. And so we bring the top three or four people to the trial because we've kind of gotten them able
to gamifying internal system. That's awesome.
Yeah. And so then we have our number one person who's a lady in our office and she's just really good at reading people. And so if they're ever in doubt, like you have, when you're picking the actual jury, like, okay, some people like this person, some people don't, I'm kind of going to her as a tiebreaker.
Mm-hmm. And there's another, you're aware of the AI called Emotion Track. Have you seen this one?
I have. Yeah. Yeah,
they're actually coming here later to the studio. I haven't seen it yet, but we just used it for trial. We're in right now. One of our trial lawyers uses. I'm interested to see what happens.
We haven't used that. I mean, we've just been a little more old school, trying to read people and get a feeling. And we're building a tribe and trying to build a tribe.
Exactly. And have you used? Again, listeners, you want to, for people on our end of the aisle, like we don't get paid per hour, we get paid perhaps. So we're going to weaponize every single advantage we can to do the most important part of the case, which is jury selection.
Yeah.
Then meeting your burden. whenever you do all your focus groups, how do you collect all that data? Because you do many. If you're in a case like this, you're doing several.
Yeah, we did 11 mock trials for this last Tesla case that we did.
Wow.
And, we'll have different juries. Like I did, and of the 11, we lost two. So we won 9, lost 2 of our mock trials. And you actually try to, you take them to lose them. So you can learn the most
from losing. Do you play the defense lawyer?
So sometimes I'll play, to tell you the truth, my favorite thing is, and I've never seen anyone else do this, I like to play both. So I get up and I do the plaintiffs and then I sit down and we have a judge who's overseeing the whole thing. And he says, okay, defense, are you ready to proceed? And I say, yes, Your Honor. I stand up and then I start doing the defense. And I do both equally. Right. So there's an equal amount of vinegar and venom in both. And then the jury doesn't know what the heck is going on. They don't know who's putting it on. And the reason I like that is twofold. Number one, it takes the person out of it. Right. So if you and I go up against each other, they might like you more. They might like me more. And that might sway them as to why they're actually going to vote a certain way. But if you do it against yourself, it removes that. And the second thing is now I have to argue the defense case, intently. And it really forces me to learn it.
Better advocate.
And here the funny thing is, so when I stand up, and I've done this a ton, and I'm doing the defense, I'm actually trying to win. You just get so competitive in this thing. I'm trying to beat us, and you just get so into it. And then the funny thing is when they come out, and after they deliberate and reach their verdict, you say, okay, who do you think's putting this on? And about half think it's, we're the plaintiff, half think they're the defense. They have no idea.
Oh, my God. And I was, on the defense side of stuff, it's just like, I feel it's so easy for them to win these cases. They have a blank check to hire all these experts that just say whatever the heck they want to say. They do all these stupid BS tests that just say what they know it's going to say.
They do. And, you know, the experts that the defense have, they just use them again and again, again. And they really will. They'll say anything. And I think on our side, you know, the experts that the plaintiffs use, I just feel like they have much more integrity. They're not just going to say what you want them to say. Their reputation's on the line. So it's just very different.
Yeah. And they don't have a, like a warehouse to run crash tests over and over again, and then hand select the videos to send you. Right. It's messed up. So anyway, so that's kind of like when you're doing jury selection for these types of cases, we kind of cover the focus groups, which are vital. You're doing product liability. You got to know what you're going in there with. Have as many eyes on them as you can when you're there. And whenever you're selecting the jury, Jonathan, you're in the moment, right? You're not taking notes.
I'm not taking notes whatsoever. So I go up there, I've got no notes. And you know, a lot of people, a lot of practitioners, they try to memorize the jurors' names. I don't do that. I'm really just into the energy of it. I'm feeling your energy and I'm trying to understand what you're feeling. And I'm trying to, as much as I can, look into your soul and see what's your story and understand, you know, what motivates you? What do you need to hear? And so I've got no notes and it's just all about the connection and really being at one with them.
Yeah. And that's where it's always good to have, you know, a team. And there's always all, even other, even if you're a young solo, there's other lawyers that will just volunteer to help you pick a jury.
Very true. I mean, I'm actually going on Sunday. I'm going to Sacramento to watch a jury trial my friend's putting on.
Oh, nice.
And I just want to go watch the experience and help the team, see if I can, you know, be beneficial in some way. And you know, I'm going to learn something. Every one of these that you do, you just learn something. And so, you know, if you're just starting out, go watch jury trials and you'll learn different ways and things that are effective and things that might not be effective for your style.
Yeah. And that's the hardest part to learn as a trial lawyer is jury selection, to learn how to get jurors off for cause. And we could do a whole seminar or a whole podcast on this and maybe we will. But, you know, the thing is, it's a lot of practice. Have people there that know what they're doing, have mentors. There's literally people that will sit next to you to help you pick these juries. And there's the televised trials are great, but they don't do jury selection just for privacy issues.
That's unfortunate, really. I mean, we've been on CVN and it's great to be on CVN. You see the trial, but the jury selection, I mean, that's where a lot of the magic happens.
Yeah. For a CVN, it's a Courtroom Viewer Network. Is that what it's called?
Yeah. Courtroom View Network.
I've had one on there too. It's very, you can pay a subscription and watch live trials, recorded trials, a great, great tool. And you know, something for, you know, to analyze, like, have you taken all of your trial transcripts and like comb through them or use any type of AI to be able to help you story arc or do stuff in the future?
I don't. You know, I every trial, whether I win or I lose, I'm just sort of traumatized from the whole experience. And I get the transcripts. Everyone wants to read them. I send them out to anyone who wants them. I just can't go back and look at it. And even I had a great opening or a great closing, I just can't. You know, I replayed over my head again and again and again, but I just don't go back and read it. I just can't.
So tell us some of the technical stuff for our listeners with the Tesla autopilot. What are the defects? You know, we talked failure to warn, 90th page of the thing. Walk us through the cause of action and why it's defective.
Yeah. So, you know, the autopilot, it's just not ready for prime time. It's just not. I mean, many people don't know this, but the Tesla autopilot is actually in beta.
Oh no, I didn't know that.
It's in beta. It's in beta, which if you look up the Merriam-Webster's definition of beta, it's a product that is not yet ready for production, right? So they have this in beta. They know it's in beta. They send it out and it just isn't, it's just not there. I mean, the product is just not ready. And here's the thing that people find to be not surprising, but downright shocking. Do you know that there is no regulation? There's no federal regulation, no state regulation over autopilot whatsoever.
Really?
None. Zero.
And when they do the federal regulation, they'll start a committee that's just the auto manufacturers that are head of the committees that write their own rules. A lot of people don't know that. They literally will have their own, they're governed by their own people. It's crazy.
They are. And even that for the autopilot, you know, it's a ways out. So right now it's the wild, wild west. And that's why I think this is such a ripe opportunity. And one of the motivating factors for us doing the Tesla case, I mean, look, one, you want to win for sure. And you want to help your client. But the other is to bring publicity to this issue that's just been lurking in the shadows for years. And we succeeded in that in spades.
So let's go through the defects. One, they're in the beta. How does it fail? And then what is the failure to warn, the consumer expectation test? Let's walk through.
So it's in beta and it's doing several things. One is it'll steer when it shouldn't steer. It'll not stop when it should stop. I mean, we're seeing this time and time again. And you know, there are just a number of conditions where it just won't work properly. I mean, we've got 9 Tesla Autopilot cases. Wow. We just actually picked up a case last month where, true story, there is a family, young family, and they're driving across country, 80 miles an hour down an open country road on autopilot. And there's a fire truck that was pulled over the side, partially sticking out in the lane, which they're supposed to do to protect the motorists that they're helping. And the Tesla Autopilot just drove straight into the back of the fire truck at 80 miles an hour. I mean, it's just not ready for prime time. And the problem is, you know, when you're using the autopilot, you're not really being hypervigilant. And if you are being hypervigilant, then what do you need the autopilot for? Right. Yeah. So you're kind of just, you're looking around, you're chit-chatting, you might have your hands on the wheel, but you're not just really paying attention. And there's a concept called automation complacency, where the automation complacency, where the brain starts to, you know, the reaction time is drastically slower than if you're driving. So people just get lulled into a sense of security.
I see. That's probably a human factors issue that you had in trial.
It's a big human factors issue. Yeah. So for example, if you're driving 70 miles an hour and there's a car that stops in front of you, you have to see it. Your brain has to process it, tell your foot to stop, and then your foot actually presses the brake. That takes about 1.6 seconds if you're driving, right? When you're using on autopilot, 3.6 seconds.
Wow, because you're that expectation that it's helping you.
You're just not paying attention the same way. I mean, you might be.
That makes total logical sense.
Yeah, you're not necessarily falling asleep or daydreaming, but you're just not. I mean, that's the whole point of having autopilot. Yep. And if you're being hypervigilant, then why do you need autopilot? And here's the other thing that I think people find surprising. So there's 6 different levels of automation. You know, from level 0, which is 0 systems, like back in the 1950s, just gas pedal and a brake, all the way up to a level 5. So 0, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 5 is fully automated. And if you ask people, where is the Tesla autopilot system? Which, by the way, they also call full self-driving. Mm-hmm. Full self-driving. You know, people think it's probably a 4 or 3. It's actually a level 2 system.
Really?
It's a level 2 system.
You know, that one thing that I was jokingly telling people when it first came out, I was like, you know what the best thing is they can't even advertise it for? Is you can be drunk as a skunk, put on autopilot, at least help guide you home.
Yeah. Yeah. And we actually have that case as well. In the Midwest was coming out of a bar really, really wasted. They put on autopilot because they thought that was the best thing to do. Autopilot started driving down the wrong side of the street.
Oh, Lord.
And I went head on into a motorist.
And again, the challenge of that case is, Tesla screwed up. They weren't ready for prime time, but...
Yeah, what's he doing drinking and driving?
That's a challenge. I think that's the altruistic thing that what you're doing is you know you're going into that courtroom and you're likely going to have some sort of fault on your person.
You will. And you
embrace that.
You do, and you have to lean into it. And so the more people start to understand, you know, the deficiencies with this, you know, the more publicity, just the better it is for all of us.
Yeah. And there are, just for our listeners, there's some states that are better than others for trying product liability cases. California is a pure what's called comparative state. So even if your person's 99% responsible, the jury says they're 1% responsible, there's still recovery. But there's some states where your person has to be less than 1%.
Yeah. So, I mean, Virginia, I mean, if you have really any, it's a complete bar. I mean, if you're 5% at fault, it's a complete bar. You know, most states other than California's on the one extreme, Virginia's on the other, but there's a lot of states that you're 50% responsible, 50. It's a bar.
That's like Massachusetts is like that and others. So you just be cognizant of whenever you have a product liability case, there's a chain of, you know, people, it could be even Amazon now under some law, but it depends on who the manufacturer is, who the distributor is, who the local person was that sold it. So before you even file a case, talk to an expert like Jonathan Michaels to see, hey, what state is probably the best venue for this? Because it matters. If you found the wrong place, man, you might be dead on arrival.
You could be toast. It's funny because we have a case that's in Indiana, which is a 50% comparative fault. And so the trial that we did earlier, the mock trial we did earlier this week, we know we're going to win the case. I mean, it's a home run of a case. The liability is clearly there, but our guy, you know, might have some responsibility. So we actually tried just the comparative fault issue. And the jury came back 15% against our guy, 85% against Tesla. So we're good, right? But you don't know. I mean, what if the jury comes back at 40% or 50%? I mean, do you really want to invest $1 million, $3 million of fees?
And the jury, unfortunately, juries don't know that.
No, they don't understand.
I mean, you can message the best you can when you're closing. Like, look, if you put this person more than 40%, you know, responsible, they don't learn their lesson. This continues to happen over and over again. You do what you can.
You do what you can. But that was what had been beneficial for us to try that case to see see, you know, what messaging they needed to hear and where they would come on the comparative fault issue. So, because the case is not in California, if it was a California case, I wouldn't have done that, but it's an Indiana case, so we needed to.
So whenever you have, so the failure to warn, walk us through that issue and how you do it.
Yeah. So the failure to warn, I mean, they're not, Tesla is not telling people that it's a level two system. There's no indication whatsoever it's a level two system. They're not telling people that it's in beta with any kind of appreciable understanding. Mm-hmm. And so there's a failure to warn that the system is going to lull you into a sense of a false sense of security. And it's even worse for Tesla. It's even worse than that because it's not even a failure to warn. It's in my view, it's outright fraud in some instances because they've got videos. I mean, right now on their website, they have videos demonstrating misuse. They have videos of people driving, like Tesla engineers driving their cars with no hands on the wheel whatsoever and just driving around. And you're really educating people on how to misuse the product.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't know that. That's crazy. And I think what's recently up was part of your trial or if it happened too late in time, but there's the whistleblower Tesla that was an engineer that came forward.
You know, we were unable to find any ex-employees that were able to use. And we knew of a couple and we tried to subpoena them and we were just unable to, unfortunately. Yeah.
And that's when you're fighting against Goliath here. There's a lot of people that will literally suppress the truth.
Yeah, there are. There's just a lot. And those guys, you know, the people, the engineers who work for Tesla, they have a lot to lose. Mm-hmm. And we actually had, I mean, in that case that we just tried, we had the number two person in the entire company, the person who literally is in charge of the entire autopilot system who reports directly to Elon Musk. I mean, he was the guy in trial.
Yeah, and it's hard when you have that person, that level of confidence backing their product and all those other things, like as a human being rather than an expert. Yes, man.
That's true.
So, you know, before we end the show, I want our listeners, we know how to find you. What other types of cases, if people have questions about or want to co-counsel, what are you looking for?
So great question. I mean, we have all types of defect cases. So, I mean, clearly autopilots, but there's also airbag non-deployments or inadvertent deployments, seatbelt cases, roof crush cases, tread separation for tires, fuel fed fires. So any kind of a defect, and I would encourage people, what we see a lot of, quite frankly, is, let's say there's a crash, right? Mm-hmm. Just a crash at an intersection, and there might be a $35,000 policy or $50,000 policy, something where there's a catastrophic injury and there's just no insurance. It may be that that's all there is, but there may also be a defect. I mean, the number of defects are just walked over because people don't know to look for it. So if you have a case where there's a, you know, a catastrophic injury, limited insurance, mm-hmm. let us take a look. There may be a defect. I mean, quite frankly, when we have a crash, we don't even name the other driver. Wow. We only go after the manufacturer.
And for those listeners that do, and if you reach out to Jonathan or his team, they're willing to invest the time, money, and energy to take a look at it. And if there's nothing there, they walk away and eat the cost.
Yeah, we do. And we actually have, we have a big staff. So we have engineers on staff. Mm-hmm. We've got accident reconstructionists on staff. And so we know how to look at the stuff very, very quickly and deeply and say, okay, so here's what happened. And so, if you know, we look at it and, you know, we think that's just not there, we don't charge anything for that.
Well, we're at the end of the half hour here and we could probably talk forever. And I'd love to have Jonathan on again. You know, if you have any questions, go to justiceteamnetwork.com or find our Apple channel or see us on YouTube. And now you know where to find Jonathan. He's going to be hanging out at Newport Beach, but really multiple weeks across the country, different courthouses, different places of America. And for those child lawyers who are listening, you know the struggle. And as sexy as it sounds, staying in a Holiday Inn in the middle of nowhere, eating that breakfast food every day, it does wear on you.
I've been there. Been there a lot.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to this episode of the Justice Team Podcast. And thank you for listening to this Tesla Autopilot and Product Defect Masterclass.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure being on the show, and I appreciate it.
Thank you.